From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. The U.S. Supreme Court gives Guantanamo Bay detainees the right to challenge their detentions. Meanwhile, police in a Washington, D.C. neighborhood are making motorists prove they live there before they can drive through a checkpoint. And Michelle Obama becomes a political and media target. For more on these topics, we have radio talk show host Troy Johnson of The Troy Johnson Show in Baltimore, Michelle McCallop, a freelance writer based in Beaumont, Texas. She's also the president of the Southeast Texas Association of Black Journalists, and Kevin Merida, associate editor at The Washington Post. He's also editor of the book Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. Happy Friday, folks.
Hello.
Hello.
So big news. Yesterday, 5-4 ruling, the Supreme Court decided that that the detainees at Guantanamo Bay have the constitutional right to seek release in civilian court. Kevin, what does this really mean in terms of any change in policy, law, prosecution?
Well, you know, what has happened is that the Bush administration's strategy for detention has continually been rebuffed by the highest court. And that really gives a lot of people pause, not only just politicians, but, you know, really the country, the whole idea of setting up this separate structure to detain those that we consider terrorists. I mean, on the presidential campaign trail, you see that there's a very sharp distinction. Senator Obama has, you know, viewed this, looked at Senator McCain and says this is another area where McCain supports failed Bush administration policies. And McCain, of course, has been saying that these are enemy combatants and that they have never been given the rights of citizens of this country. And so he's kind of making a terrorism argument. And so right now we have a kind of a national security terrorism debate going on in the midst of this ruling.
Michelle, a lot of times within the African community, we talk about what are the rights, privileges, and limitations of how government should enforce its laws on citizens and what the limits are of basically people's freedom of association, et cetera, because that has at certain points been abused, you know, in the past. How do you think, is there any special perspective that some members of the Black community bring to a discussion like this?
I certainly think so, because as you said, it's been abused in the past. And I just think it sets a bad precedent. You know, here in the United States, we have the rights and privileges and protection under the law. But anytime you have the kind of system that's being set up there where you can be detained for years with no protection, no information, I just think that it really leaves a bad taste in the mouth of African Americans for a system where you just don't have any information because it can be abused. And if it's allowed to go on in that part of the country or that part of the world, then, you know, African Americans think that it can expand and go on elsewhere. And so I don't have a problem with the ruling of the Supreme Court. I think that people who are detained should know why they're detained and have a right to fight against it. Certainly we want to protect ourselves against terrorists, but I do think that people who are locked up should have some rights available to them.
Troy, could we pay for this? And what I mean by that is, you know, the lawyer for Osama bin Laden's one-time driver, that driver is currently in Guantanamo Bay. The lawyer said he will seek dismissal of charges against the driver based on the new ruling. Could we, you know, despite the debate, pay for this down the road in terms of people who get out?
Absolutely. I think there are some long-term costs to this because it violates what we're supposed to stand for as a nation. You know, the law basically says that enemy combatants being held with the law that we have in place, it's supposed to be used when we're at war with a sovereign nation. So we violated the law. We're at war with an ideology. We're at war with the broad view of terrorism, with al-Qaeda. But it's not a nation. It's not an army and a navy. You know, so I think we're in trouble. There's still, you know, I was looking at an article. There are 275 people still at Guantanamo Bay. The United States plans to try 80 of these detainees as war crime tribunal. But again, like we've stated, these people haven't had information on what's going on with them for in excess of 6 years in some cases. So, yes, I think there are some long-term effects. We need to fix this problem.
I'm going to go to another hot story, and it's actually in D.C. where you are, Kevin. Recently, police set up car checkpoints in the Trinidad neighborhood. People driving have to show their IDs to prove they live there and or explain why they're traveling into the neighborhood. And the checkpoints were discontinued last night, but they might be implemented again. Last weekend, police said they turned away about 50 motorists trying to get into the neighborhood. So, Kevin, why were the checkpoints instituted, and what's the buzz in D.C., not just from residents of the neighborhood, but from other folks in D.C.?
Well, they were instituted because there have been a number of drive-by shootings that were from vehicles, and there's been a lot of just violence recently in the district all over the city, but that neighborhood particularly with some gang disputes. So they tried this. I think one of the problems was that the police chief had not really consulted the neighborhood residents and leaders before instituting it. But the reaction was mixed in the neighborhood, actually. I mean, there were a lot of people who didn't like it because it was inconvenient. They had to slow down. It made passage in and out of the neighborhood. Some longtime residents said, hey, you know, when we had the crack wars back in the 80s, you know, we didn't see this many police around. They weren't instituting checkpoints. and so here they are now. But there were others who were saying that until we have some other measures, we get more cops around, and that this at least stops, makes us feel a little safer. So there was a kind of a mixed reaction, of course, by civil libertarians and others who found this, including, you know, and city council people, just thought it was not very well executed. Some people thought that, hey, what we need to do is get back to community policing.
Let me just jump in for a second, because NPR's All Things Considered actually spoke to a few residents in the Trinidad neighborhood, and let's hear what they had to say.
Well, I feel better because I know the boys going to run back and hide from them if they see them anywhere around. So I know I'm safe if they ain't, you know, around. But when they disappear and they be going on, then that's when they'll come back in here. And
that's violating your constitutional rights on how they ask you where you're going, your phone number, and if you know anybody that live around here for you to come around here.
Well, I mean, I'm saying now, I just get off work, right? I come home expecting I'm going to come my normal way. I got to ride all the way out my way. Ain't nobody paying me for my gas.
That's keeping that gas is high. You
yeah,
know?
That pretty much sums it up, Troy. It's like civil liberties, whatever, but my gas. Right, don't mess with my gas. What do you think about the reactions, Troy?
You know, I think it's there are obviously some logical people in these communities, and we are so insular. You know, we've dealt with this for many, many years. The fact that people don't really voice their opinion until there's a microphone in front of them, in front of their faces, is a problem. You know, it would have been a great idea. Okay, if there's a rash of violence, and again, you know, Washington, D.C. is right down the street. We have the same types of problems in Baltimore, just like you do in major metropolitan cities. But, you know, if the police are reacting to situations that are going on in that community, then fine, set up the checkpoint. And that, like any military operation, should be the beginning, the spearhead. Let those officers fan out and then begin to do the community policing that is needed. Let them walk the, you know, if you got as many cops down there as it seems like, let them start walking that neighborhood and talking to people and really finding out what the issues are.
Right.
And then as for all these protesters, you know, they show up when something happens. They're reactive. We're reactive. Maybe some neighborhood watch programs while you got all these folks walking around would be a good way to get the answer to this.
All right. We have not very much time left. And Michelle, I'm going to ask you to kick off a different topic. First Lady Michelle Obama, question mark, we'll find out. Now, folks are starting to dig into her. Fox News called her Obama's baby mama. Uh-huh. There's websites, rumors about whether or not she used a racial slur. No evidence of the sort, but it's going around. Do you think that she is, A, getting unfair scrutiny, and B, do you think she's up to the task of dealing with it?
I don't think that she's getting unfair scrutiny. I think it comes with the territory of being potentially the first African-American first lady. It's all part of the process, and I think that she's certainly up to the task. She's a very intelligent woman, very strong-willed. But I think the public relates to Michelle Obama. She's a working mother. She's educated. She's a good role model, and she talks a lot about her success story, you know, coming from the south side of Chicago and possibly being the first African-American first lady. And I think many women and many people in general can relate to that type of story. We all want to hear that we can rise above our circumstances, and it's not where you come from. That doesn't determine where you're going. So I think just her story in general will help her a lot to deal with the challenges that are coming, and she has to know that they're coming. And that's just part of politics.
All right, Kevin, we have just a tiny smidge of time. There's also an internet fight. Barack Obama launched something called FightTheSmears.com. There's also a Republican website out that is basically, you know, framing, you know, him and trying to pull out various rumors. This FightTheSmears.com is kind of a response to that. Do you think that that was a smart political move for the Obama campaign?
Yeah, I think in this viral world that we exist in now, I think that you have to fight that with your own kinds of sites. I mean, he's not the first to do that, and I think it was probably wise and in keeping with his other online innovations.
All right. Well, guys, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Michelle McCallop is a freelance writer based in Beaumont, Texas, and president of the Southeast Texas Association of Black Journalists. Kevin Merida is an associate editor of The Washington Post and editor of the book Being a Black Man at the Corner of Progress and Peril. He joined us from the studios at The Washington Post. And Troy Johnson is a talk radio show host in Baltimore, Maryland. He joined us from the studios at The Baltimore Sun. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We are going to talk a little bit about video games and their influence on kids. Now, if you're a parent, you may know that the video game world is worth millions and millions of dollars. And here's a little bit of what you might hear in your home every day. According to the Entertainment Software Association, video game sales reached almost $19 billion last year. But can video games and other entertainment technology help kids with their education and even their careers? It's the question we're putting to three experts. Jerome Mitchell teaches computer science, engineering, and statistics at W.T. White High School in Dallas, Texas. Tara McPherson is an associate professor at the School of Cinematic Arts at the University of Southern California. She's also a researcher for the MacArthur Foundation's Digital Media and Learning Initiative, and our own tech guru Mario Armstrong is here. He has put together a program dedicated to inspiring students to pursue science, technology, and engineering. It's called Dream, Create, Go. Hi, folks.
Hi.
Hello, Fry.
Hey, how you doing?
I am doing great. So let's talk about some of the programs that you guys are working on and using to connect kids with science and technology. Mario, obviously you're a great friend to our show, and you're someone who's wearing many hats, including working with kids. Tell us about your program. Why'd you launch it? What does it do?
Okay, so really at the heart of our company, our technology media company, for the outreach part, we have a summer camp, an after-school program, a high-tech fashion show, and the Urban Video Game Academy, and this new one, the Dream Create Go. And all of these things, all of these efforts, all of these programs are aimed at middle and high school students, specifically in urban areas, to really expose, explore, and excite and inspire students on how science and technology are involved in everyday products or in everyday things that they can relate to, thus getting them to be interested in wanting to know more about the math and science behind it, which is our goal, to get them to want to pay attention in the classroom. So we use tools through our programs that kids relate to, like video games and others, to get them connected, and then we start to teach them and get them to learn more and better things about science and technology so that they can remove the barriers that are in their minds or the challenges that are in their minds.
So once you get them hooked, what kind of skills are you teaching them that may not have to do directly with gaming or, you know, even computers?
You know, social interaction, number one. How do you develop products within a team? How do you talk to your team members to go from point A to point B? Those are interpersonal skills, life skills. How do you deal with conflict resolution? So all of these things that may not be seem to be addressed in a technology camp or a technology after school program, we consider those things. We also consider how our imagery is being portrayed in video games and in technology and bring those social discussions to the forefront. So we're really having this roundabout ecosystem of learning, not just about the science and tech, but other things that are impacting our kids as well.
Tara, it sounds like this is right up your alley as well. You're with you wear a couple of hats, but one of them is working with the MacArthur Foundation, which has this multi-million dollar initiative. So when you hear Mario talk about what he does, how does it relate to what you do? And tell us more about that.
It's really right up the alley of the Digital Media and Learning Initiative for the MacArthur Foundation, which wants to take very seriously the engagement children from a very young age through post-college have with new media technologies. And rather than incite some moral panic that kids are playing video games too much, instead really engage the kids and see what they are learning from these forms and how we need to scaffold those forms of learning to get the kind of outcomes that were just being described so that kids develop literacies around media to understand when you use particular media to communicate certain things in a very visual and audio-driven world, who controls the media, who owns it, so you know when people are trying to sell you something, but also to start to learn some higher order problem-solving skills that many experts believe are embedded in some video game play.
Give me a very specific example of one of the projects that's part of this initiative.
There are a couple really interesting. One is based in Chicago with charter and after school groups that's run by Nicole Pinkard out of the University of Chicago that engages children in technology through the production of music, which already for urban youth, in this context mostly African American youth in the south side of Chicago, is a very technologically driven and powerfully expressive form. So the students learn different technological skills and those key aspects of teamwork by producing music, distributing that online in different formats.
Well, Jerome, I want to go to you because you're actually in the classroom. You're teaching computer science, but also engineering and statistics. What kind of students do you have, and how do you get them interested in what you're doing?
Well, I end up with a wide variety of students, both your typical average students as well as the higher-level students that one would expect in a computer science or engineering classroom. And the key, as I believe Mario mentioned a little earlier, is finding ways to have the students actually relate to the material. And in my case, because I am a classroom teacher, relate that material to what goes on in other classrooms. The things that a student learns in, say, a math class has practical applications, but a lot of the kids don't see it. If you want to show a child how to add matrices of numbers, there's not a lot to grab onto. If you tell a child, we're going to show you how they did the Keanu Reeves special effect where the bullet slowed down and you could see little after images of him, that makes sense. That's practical, and that's something that they're learning the math for in a high school-type situation. They just don't know it yet. So in the engineering class that I teach, it's the Infinity Project that's sponsored by Southern Methodist University. We actually show them the practical usages of what they're learning in their regular classes by bringing in that technology.
Have you ever had, you probably have had many, but give me an example of an aha moment for a kid when maybe they were like grudgingly going through the coursework and then figured out, hey, this is really worth something.
Well, I actually want to bounce off of something Tara mentioned in terms of the digital music. A lot of our younger students are heavily, heavily into forms of music that are mostly done with computers, not necessarily via instruments. So when you want to teach someone, say, signal processing, if you tell a kid to multiply a formula times a constant, that really means nothing. But if you show them their voice and then say we want to increase it, we want to make it louder, functionally you're doing the exact same thing, and you can draw that parallel between the math of the math in the math class and what they're doing in real life when they turn that little knob up. So from there, once they turn that little knob up, they understand what's going on, they've made that parallel, suddenly it makes sense on the math side. So again, through practical applications, you can actually get them into all of the more theoretical stuff you want them to learn in other classes.
Well, in case for folks who are just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea, and we're talking about how video games and entertainment technology can help kids learn math and science. We're talking to Tara McPherson, associate professor at the University of Southern California and a researcher for the MacArthur Foundation. Also, Jerome Mitchell. We were just hearing from him. He teaches computer science, engineering, and statistics at W.T. White High School in Dallas, Texas. And Mario Armstrong, News and Notes tech guru. Now, let's go with this from a parent perspective. Mario, I'm going to start with you. Because you deal with kids, you also deal with parents. And, you know, sometimes, this was something we talked about in an education series that we did, some parents are actually resistant to their kids learning because of their own bad experiences as children in the classroom. Do you ever run into cases where the kids are fairly gung-ho, but the parents have some fear?
Absolutely. Especially when you're talking about when we launched the Urban Video Game Academy. I mean, just the name of that alone. And I think Teresa touched on this earlier. Tara touched on this earlier, the moral panic of video games. But yeah, so there is this fear because they have not grown up with the same tools that our kids today have grown up with. And they don't quite understand, some parents that is, don't quite understand exactly how these tools can have positive benefit and how they actually can relate to core academics and actually relate to powerful careers that can give them a future of sustainability and possibly even entrepreneurship. So when we have those types of situations, you really have to deal with them very cautiously, and you have to show them the connectivity. If you can show parents, if parents can open their minds up and just listen and absorb the message that, wait, a video game designer is not just a video game for shooting games. There are strategy games. There are games for healthcare. There are games for medical research and simulations. NASA uses video games. All of these other areas and applications where video games can be utilized, and that's just one particular area of video games. But when you're dealing with parents, it's important for them to see exactly how you're piecing together the puzzle of the future and how this impacts their child and gives them a sustainable future. And when you do that, they seem to be more relaxed. But when you talk engineering, and some of the households I've had to talk engineering, it is foreign talk. And it's important you raise that point, Farai, because if the parents don't give that that support in the home, it makes it even more challenging for those kids that are interested in these science, technology, and engineering math tracks.
Tara, what do you hope is the long-term ramification of the work that you're doing with the MacArthur Foundation in terms of social justice, for example, when you don't have nearly as many percentage-wise African-Americans and Latinos going into high-level science as you do whites and Asians?
Yeah, there's, I think, a real potential problem in the future that access to digital technologies in meaningful context won't be available to people from lower economic status. One of my colleagues, Ellen Sider, has written a very interesting book, The Digital Playground, that looks at unequal access in, you know, LA and Southern California in elementary schools to technology. And I think one of the hopes of the MacArthur Foundation is through carefully selecting some edge or model projects, we might model best practices for the future and begin a large national dialogue about what kind of infrastructure we need in place for the education system to make sure that the digital technologies don't increase the divide between those with access and those without.
And Jerome, you know, my mom was a teacher for many years, and I remember once going out with her and some of her kids for, you know, sort of enrichment field trip. And we saw this kid it was really cold out, it was late fall, kind of struggling down the street without a proper coat on, but carrying an enormous stack of video game cartridges. And sometimes it seems like the spending patterns in, you know, a lot of our communities are like, well, we'll buy the technology and we'll spend a lot on it, but learning about it is just not even on the table. What about, you know, the idea that people are investing in technology, but only on a superficial level?
Well, I think it's closer to say people are investing in what they know about. If you don't know what it means to be an engineer, then you can't pursue that train of a career. If you don't know that, in theory, you can actually download the code to create games on an Xbox 360, you'll never go there. So you never have that kid who, it sounds like, if he knew about it back then, would have gone down the I make video game road, be, because it, obviously he loved games. So if he didn't know that he could do that, then he's never going to. I think one of the big problems is getting it out there what the possibilities are to all communities, not just those communities who already are conducive to that line of thinking.
Mario, we talked about the billions of dollars that are being made in the industry. This has got to be a growth career. I mean, do you hope that some of the kids that you work with are going to go into, you know, not just other science and technology, but the gaming industry and actually start making some money?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we're shooting for at first and foremost is attitudinal change, because it points right to his comment of how do we change the attitudes to move you from consumption to creation. If we can change your attitude at the middle school level and inspire you to learn about people, exposure hasn't been really talked about too much in terms of role models, but that's another thing that's key, and then I'll answer your question. Like Lonnie Johnson, who is the African-American developer of the Super Soaker. When I show this on stage to kids, when we do our show and we bring a Super Soaker on stage and we shoot water and we do science experiments on a laptop that can handle it, it blows the kids away that an African-American who was a former NASA engineer, an aerospace engineer, created and made millions off of the Super Soaker. When you show them Jerome Solomon, who created or led the team of the video Transformers and the development of those characters, and that they have 10 million polygons, which is geometry language, now you have kids engage. So yes, I want to see us change the industry. I want to see us, more importantly, change the pipeline. And we have a lack of diversity in a lot of careers, but specifically in the video game industry, we're looking at 5.1% of African Americans in that field. So we need to change that and get more women into the science and technology stream as well.
Tara, what about you know, the practical applications for economic development? I mean, you know, you're obviously dealing primarily at this point in an educational context, but what kind of, not just in terms of people's individual careers, but, you know, overall, what could this do for society if people actually do enter this pipeline of creativity?
I think those kind of creative and innovative jobs are the kind of the hope for Americans' economic future, right? Because those kind of jobs are very difficult to outsource or send overseas. My husband owns a video and animation company, and the creative design aspects stay here. Even engineering might be shipped overseas, but being able to think creatively and have design literacy to understand how systems are organized, how the back end and front end of computers interact with each other are very important skills for the future, and ones we do a disservice to our young people when we're not teaching science and math in a way that fires their imaginations to make those connections on their own.
Jerome, what do you hope for your kids? I mean, what's your hope for the students you're teaching?
Well, I really wish I could rewind her last sentence, because that's functionally exactly what we attempt to do in the schools. Really, what we're shooting for and we're hoping is going to occur is a real letting the students know what is actually available. If you ask your average 14 or 15-year-old, how do you become a video game designer, or even what is an engineer, they have no clue. It's our job as technology teachers to let them know, hey, this is a possibility. You can do this. And more importantly, to let all kids know from all backgrounds in all places. The big thing that I think we need to shift is having the parents who have this knowledge bring that knowledge back to the urban areas, bring that knowledge back to the minority neighborhoods and say, hey, we need to have this in our schools. If you're in Dallas, you need to have the Infinity Project in all of your schools. If you are in California, you need to have Dream Create Go in your schools, not only the affluent schools, but the lower-income schools as well, so that those students are exposed to it. Once they're exposed to it, they'll get the hook. They will do it themselves at that point. Once you know it's a possibility. But if you don't know it's a possibility, as I mentioned earlier, you can never go down that road.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Farai.
Thank you, ma'am.
We've been speaking with Jerome Mitchell, who teaches computer science, engineering, and statistics at W.T. White High School in Dallas, Texas. Tara McPherson, an associate professor at the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts. She's also a researcher for the MacArthur Foundation's Digital Media and Learning Initiative, and she was here with me at NPR West. And Mario Armstrong, News and Notes tech guru. He's put together a program dedicated to inspiring students called Dream, Create, Go. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. R. Kelly's child pornography case goes to the jury. Officials raise questions about a suspicious fire that burned down the home of rapper 50 Cent's ex and child. And BET co-founder Sheila Johnson produces a documentary for a rival TV network. Our entertainment guru, Allison Samuels of Newsweek, is here to give us the latest. Hey.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. It's always great to see you. Now, R&B star R. Kelly has sold millions of records, but Chicago prosecutors say the singer videotaped himself having sex with a 13-year-old girl. That video was produced years ago, but the trial just closed arguments and went to the jury. So, Allison, during closing arguments yesterday, the defense attorney said the case against his client is about, quote, money, money, money. And R. Kelly has a lot of supporters, a lot of people who've stood by him. Do you think that that's part of their rationale for standing by him?
The money?
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that, you know, you even go back to Mike Tyson when he had his rape case, and so many people were supportive of him back then. I think it's the celebrity thing. I think that we as Americans are just very much in awe of celebrities, and we don't want to believe the worst of them in any circumstances. But I mean, if you really looked at the way the trial went down and you look at the evidence, the evidence was pretty, you know, convincing in favor of R. Kelly being guilty. You know, they had twice as many people for the for the prosecution as it did for the defense. And that the fact that that actual video has been around for so long, and if you actually see it, it very much looks like him. It's really hard to say that it's not R. Kelly. It looks just like R. Kelly. And I think the fact that there have been so many delays in this case on R. Kelly's part, I think, is another reason why I sort of feel like he was a little afraid of how this was actually going to turn out.
Well, he said he was not guilty. 14 counts of child pornography. The young woman allegedly on the tape is now 23 years old, and she said she's not the one on the tape. So how's that going to play out with the jury, you think?
I think that that was the hardest part of, I think, the prosecution trying to bring it to trial, was that she says it's not her. But they had numerous people in her family, the young woman Sparkle, who had introduced her to R. Kelly, saying that it is her on the tape. So I think the jury has to understand that if there's any situation where the money might have been a part of it, it could have been that, because there are all these rumors that R. Kelly paid off a lot of the women that he was sort of on, you know, on video, or who had been underage that he'd actually been with. There are all those rumors out there. So I think, you know, I don't know how much of that was presented to the jury, but I think that that's well known within Chicago, that this is something that has sort of bothered him or followed him for the last couple of years.
Well, Aaliyah, for folks who don't know all that history, explain, you know.
He supposedly married Aaliyah before she was 17 years old. I think she was 15 years old when he actually married her, and the marriage was annulled. But that was something that anybody who knows R. Kelly knows about. So I think it's very hard for R. Kelly's defense to sort of say that this is totally for money when he has a history of this. And anybody, like I said, in that area and in the business, this is something I heard about him for years, way before that tape ever became public. So, I don't know. I have to hope that the jury, but I look at Michael Jackson, I look at Snoop's trial, I look at all these other trials where there's a celebrity, and even though the evidence might have been there, they were still found not guilty.
All right. Well, we have another case of celebrity and possibly down the road a court case, question mark. We're talking about rapper 50 Cent. He's got an 11-year-old son with his ex-girlfriend, Shanika Tompkins. They had been fighting over ownership of a house. Now, she lived in the house with the son, and the house burned down at the end of May. Right. Reporters asked Tompkins if she thought 50 set the fire. Here's her response.
Yes, I think he would. He's obsessed. If he can't have it, he's like, no one can. He's upset.
So
he's
very upset. So you guys are fighting over the house right now?
Yes. We were in court. We're in litigation. We're fighting over the house.
Just
yes.
To say again, what did he tell you?
He said he was going to have someone come kill me and watch what he does. And this is what he did.
So he threatened you?
Yes. And he has made no contact to even see how his son is doing. No contact.
Now, 50 Cent said that he's happy no one was hurt in the fire. He is concerned with the welfare of his child. That's what he says. How do you think this is playing out, and could this really hurt him?
Well, yes. I mean, it sounds, you know, really, you know, horrible. And given the fact that I think his sales dropped off from the last album, this certainly is not going to help his reputation. But the thing that's unfortunate for me on this is that, having dealt with 50 so many times over the years, I always really liked him and always found him to be a really nice guy, totally opposite to his persona. But the disturbing part about this is that he would sort of go to court to fight to have the mother of his child thrown out. I know one of the things he was saying, that it's his house and she was having men come over. And, you know, I think that's such a male ego kind of thing. I'm like, well, you know, you're not together with her anymore. So
you broke up.
Yeah. So why can't she have someone else come over? But I think that was his argument. But, you know, for it to be his kid, I find it hard to believe that the man would set fire to a home with his child in it, because that house burnt down to the ground. So the fact that no one was really hurt is amazing. And I find it hard to believe that he would do that to his own kid. That said, feelings, when feelings get involved, you know, you never know what people will do. But I can't imagine this is going to help his reputation, no.
Now, if this continues, mm-hmm. not even necessarily to the point of charges, but to a formal investigation, do you think that some of his big endorsement deals will fall through?
Oh, I think so. I think that's the thing. He's been such a savvy businessman over the last couple of years with so many deals with different, you know, from his clothing company to vitamin water. He's been really smart about those things. That's why it's another reason why I sort of feel like, why would he put himself in this position when he had so much to lose? But I don't think it's any way that those endorsements will stay intact when you're being accused of basically trying to kill your own family.
Well, I want to move on to another intercouple rivalry, this one on a business level at least. Bob Johnson made his name and fortune by founding Black Entertainment Television, or BET, sold the company for millions to Viacom. And the woman who used to be his business partner and his wife is now making moves of her own. Sheila Johnson is a philanthropist, part owner of a WNBA team, and now she's produced a documentary. It's called A Powerful Noise. What's it about?
It's about actually poverty and how it affects women all over the world. And in the documentary, she has a woman from Africa, a woman from Vietnam, and a woman from Bosnia. And it basically shows how no matter where these women are in the world, they still suffer from the same type of, you know, ailments because they don't have money and they're not able to make ends meet. It's a really great film. I mean, I really admire Sheila for actually doing this and sort of bringing to the world stage that most women around the world live on $2 a day and they have to take care of their children with that, and that this is something that the world needs to understand, because if women, you know, cannot survive, the fabric of the world sort of suffers. That's sort of her overall point. So it's a great documentary.
Is there any irony, or just, I guess, even common sense to the idea that it's airing on BET's rival TV One?
I think that, you know, well, Kathy Hughes is TV One, who's a woman, an African-American woman. So, I mean, in that sense, I can see where she would feel like, okay, this is someone who would understand this plight a little bit better. BET is not necessarily known for its documentaries on world, you know, the betterment of the world. So I can also see her wanting to put it on a network that was a little bit more serious than BET, which is mostly videos. But also, you know, the divorce between Bob Johnson and Sheila Johnson was very ugly. I think, you know, if anyone sort of remembers it, it was not a very pleasant situation. So I don't see why she would try to embrace BET with this.
All right. Finally, and mm-hmm. briefly, Forbes magazine has a list of the most powerful and wealthiest celebrities in the world. Four of the top 10 are Black, or Black and Cablin Asian. We're talking about Oprah, Tiger, Beyonce, and Jay-Z. Mm-hmm. What do you think it says about Blackness that, you know, they're all over this list?
Well, I think it's great in many ways, because it does show that we do have that power, we have that visibility, we have the ability to actually sell things and to invest and to be savvy in our investments. And I think that's what it shows. I think the fact that Jay-Z and Beyonce are on there, I think Oprah and Tiger we sort of expected, but I think Beyonce and Jay-Z being on there is really great, because you see this power couple, two African Americans married to each other, you know, being able to dominate, you know, in their parts of the business. And I think that's something we haven't seen in a long time. So that's what I think that was a really great part of seeing that list.
And it's always great to see you.
Thank you.
That was our entertainment contributor, Allison Samuels of Newsweek magazine, and she was right here at our NPR studios in Culver City, California. This Sunday is Father's Day. The holiday is bittersweet for people who have tense or sometimes non-existent relationships with their fathers. And the conversation around fatherhood in the Black community takes on another dimension. For some folks, the only time they see an African-American father and his children together is on television. But are the depictions that they see a real reflection of the Black experience? We've seen Bill Cosby and Bernie Mac as prominent Black TV dads, but now you're seeing hip-hop celebs on shows including Snoop Dogg's Fatherhood, Reverend Run's House, and Irv Gotti's Gotti's Way. So are these men portraying positive images of fathers or reinforcing stereotypes? For more on this discussion, we have NPR's Tony Cox speaking with Mark Anthony Neal, professor of African-American Studies at Duke University. Gentlemen, take it away.
Thank you very much, Farai. Mark, nice to have you on with us. Hey, good to talk to you, Tony.
Listen, let me set it up this way, because many hip-hop stars have come under criticism because of their lyrics and brushes with the police. The negative image of them clouds everything around them. So when people mention a reality show based on a rapper's family life, many people are they do just what you're doing right now.
I think it's important to remember that for a lot of these guys, you know, that work as rappers is just that, it's a job. Very different on who they are and what they are in terms of their home life. And I think what's really been surprising when you look at a range of these shows is that, you know, these guys turn out to be not too bad fathers. I mean, actually halfway decent. You know, they have a certain level of standards in terms of parenting that I think catches people off guard sometimes.
I think you're absolutely right. In fact, we're going to talk about Snoop Dogg's show because he did an interview in which he talked about Snoop Dogg's fatherhood. Here's a soundbite from him.
One of the reasons why I wanted to do this television show, because 90% of the rappers, males, grew up without fathers, and 100% of us are becoming great fathers. Mm-hmm. And we're breaking the chain, and we're not being appreciated or commended for that. And it's sad because they always want to say 20 rappers is in jail for this or that, or they did this. But what about the 100 rappers that's being fathers to their kids and raising them and doing positive, creative things with them?
Now, here's my Mark, here's my question for you. It seems that there is a mixed message sometimes coming from some of these celebrities, particularly because of their image professionally and what they do with their music and their videos, et cetera, and then to watch them be these good dads on TV shows like this.
Well, I think it's, you know, it's a struggle for them. You know, they're trying to make a living the best way they can. And, you know, the irony is that, you know, their work as rappers, it gives them an amount of wealth that actually makes it easier for them to be great fathers. You know, I'm with some of us who are, you know, middle class and working class, wish we had the kind of money that Snoop Dogg had to be able to invest in time with his son and be involved with them. But I think it does challenge a lot of perceptions about who these guys really are in ways that, you know, fundamentally, I mean, you can, when you look at Snoop in the context of his show, you know, he's probably closer to Heathcliff Huxtable than a lot of folks would want to give him credit for.
Well, you know, that would seem to be a stretch. I understand why you're suggesting it, but for the, you know, the average person who only knows what they see and not,
right,
you know, what goes on, you know, behind closed doors, it's hard to imagine. Even let me ask you about this, because it's not television per se, but someone like Ice Cube, for example, who has gone into making these family type movies,
right,
and to watch him, you know, it's confounding. I think that's the word I would use. Would you agree?
You know, the thing that's great about it, in the case of Snoop Dogg and Ice Cube, you know, as two examples, I mean, these are guys who've had to grow up in public. And I think very often we continue to think about them, you know, when they were 19 and 20-year-olds, which both of them were when they first came on the rap scene, and may have made decisions in their life that are very different than the decisions that they're making now as 30-something adults, you know, who have kids who are paying mortgages. I mean, the whole kit and caboodle. And I think that's what you're seeing now with these folks. These folks have been allowed to grow up in public. And, you know, like many of us, you know, in our 30s and 40s, you know, one of the things that we're concerned about all the time is parenting. How are we raising our kids? Are they going to be productive citizens, et cetera, et cetera? And I think the culture now has allowed a venue for them to express that aspect of their lives. You may not hear it in their music, but now with reality shows, you see that aspect. And same thing with Deion Sanders, right, his show that's on now.
Rapper and actor LL Cool J is advocating that young black men from single-parent families seek out father figures. He says he reconnected with his own father as his career was taking off, and he says that was important for steering him away from a life of gangs and crime. He says he did it when he kicked off, as I said, his career. Is this a good idea?
I think it's important. I mean, even when the actual father can be present, I think as many adults that can be involved in the parenting process with kids is important. And there's so many men who can play that role, even if they're not the fathers. I mean, we hear all the stories about coaches and teachers, et cetera, et cetera. But just adult figures, male adult figures around the way, you know, can have an impact in the parenting process by providing, you know, a stable situation where an adult can impose certain kinds of values and also be able to weigh in and be counsel for young kids.
Is there a way to determine, Mark, whether or not these new images, these new fatherly images of people like Snoop Dogg are having an impact on the young men and women who are watching them?
I think you would have to think so. I think our kids now watch so much television, and there's 50,000 cables or satellite channels. I think inevitably what they're seeing on television is going to impact their everyday social relations. And as they're seeing a range of different style of parents, I mean, it's no longer the 45-year-old Caucasian parent in the kind of standard family situation. I think now that they're seeing a range of different people express how they work through the parenting situation, that inevitably some of that's going to impact in terms of the decisions they make in their own lives when they become parents, but also as they're working through issues now with children.
Really quickly, I've got about 15, 20 seconds or so for you to answer this. Do you think that someone like Snoop Dogg would, what do you think he would say to his own son who wanted to become another Snoop Dogg type rapper?
I think you've seen it already in the show that he very much discourages his children making the kind of decisions and lifestyle choices that he made. I mean, I'd like to think that he would make the argument that he did what he did so that his kids could have other choices, you know, kind of like the Tony Soprano narrative, you know, all those years on The Sopranos.
Yeah, very interesting. Mark, thank you very much. A good conversation.
Good talking to you, Tony.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African American Studies at Duke University.